Thank you for your question. I could keep going, but I think I'll move on. Tonight I want to talk about this practice that's sort of a backwards perspective, I think, from the dominant paradigm in traditional Dharma practice that really comes from the Zen tradition, is this idea of a sudden awakening in a gradual cultivation. And so what does that mean? And so Dogen, who's one of my favorite Zen teachers, talks about this idea that we practice, the reason we do this practice is not to awaken, but we do the practice as an expression of our awakening, right? And this is a very liberating way to hold the practice, because really what happens is we do have these sudden awakening moments in our lives. Sometimes we call it the aha moment, but we've all had a whole range of them, and we could all probably go around and spend hours talking about moments and experiences in our life that opened us up to a new perspective or a new way of being, and we kind of had this sudden awakening. But they don't last very long. And so what needs to happen is these sudden awakenings want to inspire and encourage us to have a gradual cultivation, so which happens very, very slowly over time. And that really becomes our practice. Not because we're getting in this trap of thinking to ourselves, I come into Buddhist practice, I hear about awakening, what I'm going to do is I'm going to practice, and then someday there's going to be this event. And on the other side of that event, it's going to be aces for me. Right? And this is kind of the chasing of it. And so that's really actually a very, I think, a distorted view in a way that can kind of set us up. So essentially what we're trying to acknowledge is that we've already woken up, actually. Anybody who has entered the Dharma, who's doing this practice, who's spending time coming to classes like this, or sitting retreats, or developing a Dharma practice, or reading Dharma books, or any of the range of ways in which we practice, you're doing it already because you've essentially woken up to some degree. You've recognized some very key, poignant aspects about your experience, which is traditionally what the Buddha would call the Four Noble Truths, which unfortunately gets taught as Dharma dogma. But actually, it's really not at all. It's really, I can give you the Four Noble Truths in about 4 seconds. And this moment, have you noticed that there's something about this life, mind, body thing that's complicated and difficult? Have you noticed that when you don't get what you want, you suffer sometimes? Have you noticed that when you lose what you really want or is important to you, you suffer sometimes? Have you noticed that, generally speaking, this whole life thing feels a little bit out of joint? Like it just kind of doesn't quite work right? Have you noticed that? You got that. First noble truth, done, next. Have you noticed in those moments you react? You, in these moments of experience when there's dukkha meaning imperfect here, that in that moment where we're recognizing that something's not quite right, sometimes called craving, which is, I think, a problematic word. It's too barbaric. But there's reactivity. We react. And then as we react, we get caught up in a whole range of interesting things we could talk about for hours. What the Buddha calls dependent origination, is that our suffering originates dependent upon causes that we essentially can't have equanimity with. And so what the Buddha basically woke up to is this very interesting thing that he noticed, that I'm sure you've all noticed. Have you noticed that sometimes you suffer in your mind in ways that seem dramatically unnecessary? Right. Of course. And have you also noticed that there's things that you've done and things that you can do in moments of experience where you're actually able to overcome that? You're able to liberate yourself from the suffering in your own mind by a range of things. Have you noticed that? That's the third noble truth, is that liberation, awakening, nibbana, can actually be experienced. So our goal is to fully know and comprehend what I said about dukkha, that we know it's a thing that exists, and that we actually let go of this reactivity. We train the mind to let go of the reactivity, and then we arrive in this nibbanic moment. Stephen Batchelor calls it a nibbanic sensibility, which is the goal of practice. A sense of our mind is not reactive, and we can actually choose and operate and move through the world in a way that feels manageable, And we live in that third noble truth. And what arises out of that is this opportunity to cultivate the Eightfold Path, which starts with right view, which immediately follows this Nibbanic moment where there's no reactivity. We recognize the conditions are unfavorable. We're able to manage that, and we're able to make choices and do things in that experience without getting caught up in the reactivity. And you know, that's pretty much the whole game here. So really, Dharma practice and what the Buddha's teaching is not very difficult to comprehend. Which is one of the things that's really sort of bothered me over the years as somebody who's sat a lot of retreats and has been around Dharma for a long time. So I used to get really upset when teachers would talk about the Dharma as if it was this like mystical, kind of what I used to call Star Wars Dharma, which is like a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, there were people who weren't suffering and you ain't one of them. And you're just like, fuck, man. How long is this going to take? But it's really actually not like that, I don't think. I think it's very, very ordinary. I think that probably everybody here had probably a handful of moments today where you actually experienced everything I just said. And then, of course, it lasted for as long as it lasted, and something else happened, and you got caught up in reacting to that, and on this, what the Buddha calls dependent origination, happens to us. And so that's sort of the system. That's kind of what we're up against, right? It's nothing really that profound. This is why the thing that's so frustrating about Dharma practice is it's actually not a belief system, really. It's really a behavioral system. You know, the Buddha's not into beliefs. He's really into behaviors, which, like we talked about in the meditation, the attitude of mind. That actually my mind has a kind of behavior to it. Aversion is actually a psychological cognitive behavior. It's the mind behaves in that way, like a tantrum child. Right? Have you seen this in your mind? You know, it's not your fault. It's just sort of the way, the nature. Sometimes the best definition for Dharma is nature. The nature of the mind is to have aversion towards conditions that are unfavorable. It's just wired that way. That's sort of how the equipment was designed. And everybody has it. Get over it. Right? And so when we wake up to this and we see that there's actually value in these kinds of practices, you got it. You're there. There's no more information actually that you need to learn. There's no more books you need to read. There's no more podcasts you need to stream. You actually need to get down to brass tacks and start practicing. Right? But we don't like to do that. Why? Because this practice is profoundly difficult. You know, I don't know what it is about the equipment that came, that I was born into, but it just doesn't like to watch itself behave. It doesn't. It doesn't want to know what it's doing. Because there's a lot of disappointment in that. It's like one bad headline after another. Right? And you know, that can be actually really funny, or it can be really depressing. You know? And we all have our unique ways in which we've habituated towards certain patterns of experience. And so what we're looking for is this gradual cultivation where we acknowledge a sense of awakening, that we've woken up to some degree. Let's be honest, not everybody on this planet is trying to do what we're doing here right now. This is not the dominant paradigm. I walk around the world sometimes and I think to myself, I get so frustrated. I'm like, is anybody even fucking trying to be good? Like, is anybody, I'm like, even trying a little bit? And I think mostly not, actually. Most people are caught up in this. Getting what they want, getting rid of what they don't want. They have no idea of any of the thing that we're talking about here. But we so take it for granted, actually. So I think, I don't know what the word is. I think it's a shame to some degree that we sometimes, we really are best served to feel confident, to feel inspired, to feel encouraged that our life conditions and our life experience got us into a place where we said, wait a minute, I think there's something going on here that I have some agency over. And I actually have decided to do the hard work of that. despite all of my conditioning and what the world says and what the world thinks. It's like the Buddha calls this samvega, this kind of spiritual urgency or this spiritual courage, where we recognize, you know, all of these things I'm saying, that the Four Noble Truths, we see, that's kind of right. That's actually, the Buddha was spot on. This is actually how it goes. And the brilliance of this man who just basically systemized everything and categorized everything and gave us a highly detailed map. But, you know, we get into this problematic thing because I think, and this is so American, I think, it's like we are so obsessed with the map that we forget about the territory. There's a big difference between the map and the territory. You know, you ever go to a foreign city? I remember going to Chiang Mai and I got my little awesome map. You know what's not on the map? The weather. You know what's not on the map? The bad neighborhood where someone's going to steal my shit. You know what's not on the map? The good restaurants. You know, it's like, you know, we get this map, but we really don't understand or we don't realize or acknowledge that the map is basically helping us guide our way through our own subjective kind of territory, the environment of our psychosomatic emotional experience, which for everybody, let's be honest, totally different. I don't know what it's like in there. I kind of know what it's like in here, to some degree. And so what it does is we want to have curiosity into that, well, in a sense of being interested about how our minds operate. And I think actually being honest, which I think is a really overgeneralized term, I think self-honesty is very difficult. I think coming to terms with our own limitations as humans is like really one of the most difficult things to do. But it's also very contagious if you see somebody else do it. You know, that's the one thing I love about the Dharma communities. It's like there's this tremendous willingness. And one thing that has made the Dharmas feel so trustworthy to me is there's this tremendous permission to suffer. I remember when I was introduced to Dharma practice as a teenager and I was suffering so bad. And it was just almost like you're allowed to suffer here. It's like, and it's almost actually, it's normalized and it's to some degree understood as kind of like, you know, what we're up against. It's not about me and my life and all the bad things that happen and how come this and how come that and living in this subjective reality of my own experience and why is it so difficult in here for me to be a person living in a world, right? Which is basically what most people do, right? But then we start to have an appreciation for the kind of experiential aspect of life. And also having to, as we are all what we would call householders, as we have jobs and we have apartments or houses, and we have to navigate the tricky terrain of living in kind of modern society. We can't dismiss that, but we also can bring a contemplative framework to how we do that in a way where we can create less suffering for ourselves. And so there's this opportunity for this gradual transformative practice that unfortunately I've noticed it's hard to monitor and to track your own progress because it happens very slowly, which is why the Buddha uses the term, he doesn't use the term meditation. I actually don't like that word at all and I try not to use it. It's a very actually European Enlightenment, almost Judeo-Christian term, meditation. It's nowhere to be found in any of the Buddhist tradition. It's a very English term that we kind of added. But really this term bhavana, which means to cultivate. So the Buddha, when he talks about practice, Dharma practice, he's talking about cultivating things. We want to cultivate awareness. We want to cultivate loving kindness. We want to cultivate compassion. We want to cultivate gratitude. There's a whole bunch of things that came in your equipment that can be unlocked and developed and brought into fruition. But we have to cultivate those. And so just like the analogy of cultivation, if you take a seed and put it in dirt and you give it care and attention, it slowly over time it grows into a kind of fruit. But you know, if you planted a seed in the dirt and sat there and looked at it, you know, you go fucking bananas, unless you recorded it and sped it up really quick. That's what we want to do in our practice. We want to record it and speed it up really quick. But that's not how it goes. Right? It happens really, really slowly. And then we start to realize we have this whole garden. It's not like, well, so how's the awareness seed doing? How's the compassion seed doing? How's the gratitude seed going? How's the generosity seed going? You know, there's a whole bunch of things we need to kind of take care of. So we have to be very careful that we don't do what seems to be, again, the dominant paradigm of putting all our eggs in the mindfulness basket. You know, mindfulness, mindfulness, mindfulness. You know, it's one of eight factors of the Eightfold Path. So if we're trying to be fully liberated and we're only doing mindfulness, we're going to at best be 15% liberated. And that's not really what I'm looking for. I just go back to sleep. 15% is the bar. Fuck it, let's go get a drink and just call it a day, you know? But we do that. We and I don't know why that is, and I don't know, I'm not trying to say it's anybody's fault. It just sort of seems to be the way it is. And so when we look at this Eightfold Path, if we look at these Four Noble Truths, there is this moment of dukkha, there's this arising of reactivity, there's the letting go of reactivity, the experiencing of nibbana, and then an opportunity to have a whole lifestyle that is actually based on that idea. And so to keep it more simple, it's better to look at it through three trainings of Sila, Samadhi, Panya.
Would you just say there's last five or six words?
Yeah. Sila, Samadhi, Panya, the training of the Eightfold Path, which I'll talk about in English. But it's really this, we train the mind, so that's mindfulness, there's effort, mindfulness, and concentration, which is part of the mental training that we have to cultivate the mind. But we have to cultivate the mind, we also have to cultivate sila, which is a way of saying, it's usually translated as like morals and ethics, which is highly problematic. But really I think what we're looking at is our integrity. Really what sila is our integrity to discipline, or really our integrity to our own values. Not subscribing to necessarily even the Buddhist values, but like to actually feel under, well, what is it that I value? And if I value in, you know, honesty and generosity and kindness, what is my how much integrity do I have towards my values? In Eve Ekman's work, Cultivating Emotional Balance, they call it cognitive balance. Are my values and my behaviors in line? Yeah, that's pretty hard to do, actually, for our values and our behaviors to be congruent. But that's the training in sila. So that takes discipline. What is our discipline to our own integrity? And in the Buddhist tradition, it's an integrity to nonviolence. It's an integrity to kindness. It's an integrity to generosity. To generally non-harming. You know, which is, you know, not easy to do. But there's a lot of non-harming that's easy to avoid. You know. I mean, I haven't beaten up anybody on the streets since I was a kid. You know, it's easy, actually, a lot of it, to not engage in. But then there's really, I think, in the current landscape of the world we live in, there's this way in which we engage in psychological harming, emotional harming. And a lot of it, we harm ourselves so terribly. Just in the way that I behave in my own mind. Like, sometimes I'm totally blown away and disappointed about some of the things that my mind still tells me about me. I'm like, really? Still? You know, this internalized, really kind of, it's really, I experience it a lot of times as violence in my own mind. You know, and also can be towards other people. You know, it's not physical violence, but there is psychological violence. And having to be honest about that, and you know, a lot of times for me, having to be honest about some of the things that go on in my mind is hard to bear. You know, but if I can't recognize it with awareness, then there's not much I can do about it. Then I'm just in denial, or what the Buddha would call ignorance. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I totally don't have any violence in my mind. It's like the white person who's not racist. It's like, really, dude? Like, no racism in your mind at all? Like, you know, that's just completely denial. You know, we have to be honest about this. And it's not even like my mind, it's the mind, and my mind's been conditioned in a way largely that has nothing to do with me or my fault, but I've inherited a whole boatload of really unskillful conditioning from my parental system, from my culture, from the world I grew up in, from my trauma. You know, it's not my fault. I don't have to be accountable for it, but I need to be responsible for how it guides my movement through the world. And so we the more we train the mind, the more we can have this seal of this integrity to our discipline. And it's sila samadhipanya. So it's integrity, meditation, then wisdom. And wisdom, of course, is such a problematic term. What the hell is wisdom? It's such an ambiguous. What does that mean to be wise? To have wisdom, what does that actually look like? And I think in a very real way, wisdom is an understanding of our limitations. As a human being, I'm limited in a whole range of ways. And how am I limited? And how honest and how much can I acknowledge where my limitations are? And at the same time, how much can I acknowledge the possibilities? How good can I get? You know, this is the whole East-West thing. As in the West, dare I say the West, I don't think we can say that anymore, but in American culture, let's say, I grew up in a culture that's very pathologizing, derogatorizing, where we're very obsessed and concerned with what people do that's wrong and bad. You know, we have a whole diagnostic on mental disorders. We pathologize literally everything. There's almost a disorder for, you know, if you brush your teeth too much, I'm sure there's a fucking disorder for it. You know what I mean? And so we are very interested in what people do that's wrong and bad and where that comes from, which is actually turns out to not be very helpful to some degree. Where in the East, in the Buddhist tradition, they're actually very interested in how good can people do. You know, the whole Buddhist tradition is like, how good can we do as human beings? How well can we be? How well can we thrive? You know, it's much more interested in that side of the equation. How much kindness and awareness and wisdom and compassion, how much, you know, can I actually be happy in this world? But, you know, if we look at, again, if we go back into science, which I think is fairly trustworthy at this day and age, it's like, you know, even like the neuroscientists and all these people who are in the contemplative neuroscience camp, like a Richard Davidson is kind of the, and Dan Siegel and all these kind of guys, who are pointing out that well-being and happiness are actually skills. They're behaviors. They're not beliefs. So what you believe and what you think and the views that you hold are only as deep or only as valuable in your ability to actually live as if that were the case. And we can see, like, you know, the belief systems that people have. Look at the violence and the harm that gets caused in this world because you believe something different than me about, like, some figure up there, maybe. It's insanity. You know, so when we start to really kind of think about this as a gradual cultivation, we want to be able to acknowledge our practice is much more than sitting quietly on a cushion and paying attention to our breaths. But part of our practice is our relationship with other people, the way that we see our speech, the way that we communicate with people, how we work in the world. I bet you a lot of you, and probably everybody in this room, does so many good things in this world for yourself and other people that you give yourself zero credit for. Because again, we've privileged this meditative, like, well, I'm not good at meditating or whatever the hell that is. But we don't recognize other areas in our life where we're actually doing really well. Maybe we're doing work in the world that's meaningful to us, or we have relationships with people that we appreciate, or, you know, we're involved in some sort of social, ecological way in which we're trying to actually improve the quality of life on the planet for other people. Why is that not part of Dharma practice? I don't know. I think it definitely is. But we can oftentimes leave that out for some reason. And it's a much more comfortable way to go about things, I think. So this idea that we're going to practice, 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 and wake up is, I think, back asswards. I think that actually we've already woken up in many ways. Probably in all the ways in which we need to. And then what we have to do, we have to act as if that's the case. Right? And you're going to have varying degrees of success with that, which is also part of it, right? That I'm limited. I can't always do the right thing. I can't always do the Dharma thing. I sometimes do the, like, other thing. And that's okay too, right? That's part of the game here, I think. So I will go over time if I don't stop, so I will stop there. Thank you.